The day after, what the New Hampshire primary results mean or don't mean for the presidential race. Surely you've heard the news by now. Bernie Sanders won the New Hampshire primary, but not by as wide of a margin as he did 4 years ago. Pete Buttigieg was close behind in second and now leads in the delegate count, barely. Amy Klobuchar surprised most pundits with her third place finish. And the rest of the candidates were way behind. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss what these results mean in the race for the White House. Can Biden or Warren recover from their poor showing in New Hampshire? Who voted in yesterday's primary and who didn't? What does it mean for Mike Bloomberg's candidacy? What do you think? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Yesterday, voters in New Hampshire went to the polls in the first in the nation presidential primary. The results were somewhat expected, but had a surprise or two as well. So, what's next? In the studio with me to help answer that question, Ron Schmidt. He is professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine, and his most recent book is Reading Politics with Machiavelli. And on the line with us from New Hampshire is Andy Smith. He's a political science professor at the University of New Hampshire and director of UNH's Survey Center. As always, we want to hear from you. How did your candidate fare in yesterday's primary? Have you even settled on one candidate? Share your thoughts at email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Andy Smith, I know it was probably a late night for you in New Hampshire as you wake up and rub your eyes. What are you thinking about today?
Thinking about where the candidates go from here and where the Democratic Party goes from here. I think the party is still stuck with trying to figure out who can be an electable candidate in November, and I don't think that is too much clearer now than it was the day before. I think that on my initial questions are, when do Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren decide that it really isn't going to happen this time around and throw in the towel? I think that's the questions that are being discussed within their campaigns today. So those are the two big things. And I guess the other one is that Trump enthusiasm is something I've never seen before with an incumbent president. His turnout was more than doubles what Obama was when he ran for re-election in 2012. So 128,000, 129,000 Republicans voted in the Republican primary only for Donald Trump. Only 49,000 voted for Obama in 2012. Trump almost had record election rate or a record primary rate for an incumbent. He was only like a half a point behind Ronald Reagan in 1984.
Oh, wait a minute. So yesterday in the New Hampshire Republican primary, the president, 149,000 people in a state that's a little over a million people actually went to the polls and voted for the president?
128,000.
Okay, so 1 in 10 New Hampshire New Hampshire citizens went to the polls to vote for an incumbent in a primary.
Pretty much for the adults, yes. And they voted for an incumbent. He got 85.5% of the Republican primary vote. Obama back in 1980 on the Democratic side only got 79% of the Democratic primary vote, and only 49,000 Democrats voted for him in 2012. Did I say 1980? I meant 2012.
We knew what you meant, Andy. I'm going to turn now to Ron Schmidt. As you wake up this morning and sort of think about the New Hampshire primary, what strikes you?
Well, one of the things that struck me was, was how well Senator Klobuchar wound up doing and how much of that seemed to come from voters who are making last-minute decisions. And that left me primarily wondering to what degree she's got the infrastructure in place in Nevada to try to build on that.
And that is interesting what you said about the last-minute decisions. We saw polling that showed that most voters were making their decision last minute. And I know a couple of folks who live in New Hampshire and they were making their decision last minute. So sort of my my personal experience jibes with that. So, Ron, I'm going to turn back to you. Is there an indicator that you were paying particular attention to? I know some people were looking at turnout. Some people wanted to look at how many young people were voting. Was there one particular thing that you were have really been tracking, whether it's Iowa or New Hampshire?
Well, it's funny, but to some degree, I've been paying attention to the kind of enthusiasm and energy coming from my students. I had a student who was in New Hampshire yesterday working with the Sanders campaign, and he was very much charged up in class today. But I'm also seeing a certain amount of exhaustion among my students, especially coming after the Senate trial. So just from my kind of in my backyard perspective, I'm wondering about what the next month is going to mean for participation rates on Super Tuesday.
Oh, interesting. And what about you, Andy? Was there a particular thing that you were paying attention to that maybe everybody else wasn't or most people weren't?
Well, we've been asking a question going back to mid-2017, asking how interested New Hampshire primary voters are in the upcoming primary. And among likely Democratic primary voters, this peaked at April 2018 at 75%. 75% said they were extremely interested. That was down to 60% before Iowa in January. It dropped to 52% in the wake of the muddle in Iowa. I'll be nice and call it a muddle. The impeachment acquittal by Trump and the State of the Union last week by Trump. And to me, that was one of the reasons that turnout wasn't what was predicted. It was lower than expected, and especially turnout among young people was considerably lower than it was in 2016. I think there is, as Ron was saying, that there was a sense of exhaustion and not quite a sense of panic, but it's a sense that Democrats are looking at the field and not really liking the choices right now.
Now, that's interesting because I've also heard people take a read of it saying that, you know, it's not necessarily, it's just that most Democrats say no matter who gets nominated, I'm going to vote for them.
Oh, that's always the case.
Yeah. Okay, Ron?
I'm just thinking that in the degree to which those that kind of energy maintains itself, that we've got 1,990 delegates in the Democratic Party that have to be allocated. And right now, Pete Buttigieg is at 23 and Senator Sanders is at 21. We've got a long road ahead of us. And true, the next month is going to be intense. We've got Super Tuesday and then an additional seven states after that. So a lot of those delegates are going to be determined in the next month or so. The Democratic Party, I'm a little surprised at the low level of energy that we're seeing at this point. And one of the questions for me has to do with early voting, too. I'm wondering in states that allow early voting, how many people have made the decisions already?
Yeah. So let's talk about the candidates one at a time. Andy, Bernie Sanders won with the tally I have in front of me. I think it's been updated is 25.7% of the vote. People expected Bernie to win, though. I mean, was winning 25% of the vote a good thing or a bad thing for him?
I think it was under expectations. You know, he won back. He got about 60% of the vote back in 2016. Not all of those voters were pro-Sanders voters. A lot of them were just anti-Hillary voters. But the expectation was that he was going to do considerably better, as he has been campaigning almost continuously in New Hampshire since 2016. He had a very strong organization here. He's from a neighboring state. And he was going to get all this youth vote, but the turnout among young people really, I think, surprised a lot of people at how low that was. And I think that he underperformed expectations. So he's going to be able to claim a win, but a win with less than half the votes that he got in 2016 isn't much of a win. So I think Sanders really underperformed here.
Ron, do you agree?
I do agree. And I think the decline in enthusiasm and participation among the young probably is a part of that. In a sense, I think Sanders had a good night more in terms of who else had a good night. I think that if Senator Warren or particularly Vice President Biden had a really good night last night, that would have posed more of a long-term problem for him. We have to see at this point exactly what's going to happen between Buttigieg and Senator Klobuchar and where that might go. But I think that in that sense, Senator Sanders probably did better with the two candidates who also had a pretty good night last night.
Okay, I'll turn. Go ahead, Andy.
Related to that, I think the best thing that happened for Bernie Sanders last night is Amy Klobuchar, because in our early polling, a lot of the support that she was saying, like the second choices that we were seeing, the people's second choice, was going to Buttigieg. And if she hadn't had that debate performance and gotten a lot of the media attention on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, I think a lot of those votes would have gone to Pete Buttigieg, and he would have won here. Because as it is, he only lost by, you know, a percentage point and a half or so.
Yeah, and let's talk about him next. I mean, he comes in second, 24.4% of the vote. Really, really close and leading in the delegate count. Ron, I've heard a lot of people on national news kind of write that off and say, yeah, he's not going to do so well on Super Thursday. What do you think of Buttigieg leading after two states?
He's doing, I'll admit, he's doing better than I thought he would at this point. Of course, the big question has to do with how well he's able to reach out to broader constituencies within the Democratic Party, and particularly constituencies of color. And I think we're going to begin to see people pay more attention to that problem with Senator Klobuchar as well, now that she's had such a good has such a good week.
All right. And anything you wanted to add about Pete Buttigieg, Andy, before we move on?
Yeah, I agree. He's already he's tacked pretty hard towards attracting minority votes. He got beat up on that in the debate Friday night pretty hard, and he didn't really have a good answer. He changed his stump speech quite a bit over the weekend, where he talked about his relations with the African-American community and stressing a lot of these some personal stories that he had. And he has kind of kicked off his next phase in Nevada by greeting voters in Spanish. So I think he's really working on changing that perception, or at least dampening the perception. I think by the time we get to South Carolina, though, where they have a large African-American constituency, I just don't see Joe Biden being there. And I certainly don't see African-Americans supporting Joe Biden at anywhere near the level that early polls were showing if he's that wounded of a candidate. Because, frankly, African-American voters want the same thing white Democratic voters is, and that is to beat Donald Trump in November. And when it comes down to it, how can you tell if somebody is an electable candidate? Well, electable candidates win elections. They don't lose, and they particularly don't lose by coming in fifth place.
And Andy, you mentioned Amy Klobuchar, and most people believe she did as well as she did in New Hampshire because she had, in their view, a strong debate performance. I'm looking at sort of general numbers, though, in front of me. I'm looking at Bernie Sanders with 25.7%, Elizabeth Warren with 9.2%. So about 35% of the vote went to, you know, what people are characterizing as the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And then if you add up Buttigieg with 25% and Klobuchar with almost 20, a lot higher number of 35%, just those two together. Do you read what I'm reading into it, Andy?
Well, actually, that's typical. In New Hampshire, it's about 35% to 40% of the electorate here have historically been progressive or liberal, and this is the Democratic electorate. So that's about right. And for a progressive candidate to win New Hampshire, they either have to have a one-on-one race with an unpopular moderate candidate like a Hillary Clinton, or like this year where there's essentially Elizabeth Warren's declined as Bernie Sanders rose. They were fighting over the same voters, but the progressive candidate has to depend on the moderate conservative wing of the party splitting up that vote. And I think that's what happened with Sanders this year. This is a pattern that we've seen kind of routinely in the past. Typically, though, the more moderate wing of the party, the one that has more support by the establishment of the party, especially in the fundraising and money aspects of it, is able to coalesce before you get to New Hampshire. That's not necessarily the case anymore in the era of the post-Citizens United era, where everybody can have a super PAC and raise unlimited amounts of money, and also the amount of money you can raise from small money from small donors. So the party is not as important as it used to be. It makes it harder for them to control who that moderate conservative candidate is, and I think that's one of the reasons that Bernie Sanders was able to get a win, because he did better among that rump voter, the smaller percentage of the electorate up here, they're progressive.
And long term, I think that's that's his big challenge. Back in 2016, I know a number of political scientists who said that Sanders really was what they called a factional candidate. He had very, very deeply felt support from one portion of the party, but not from a broad set of the different constituencies that make up the Democratic Party. And the question this year is whether he can broaden that out.
That's absolutely the case, because looking at the exit polls, Pete Buttigieg has by far the broadest support, and it's the most stable support across all sort of demographic and ideological groups of the people who voted yesterday.
Elizabeth Warren does not do well, 9.2% of the vote in a state that neighbors her own. Ron, is this the end of her campaign?
I don't know if it's the end of her campaign. Her campaign manager, Roger Laubs, made public a memo yesterday in which he talked about how the Democratic primaries don't have any winner-take-all states, how it's this long slog of delegate accumulation. Clearly, they're trying to send the message that they think they have what it takes to endure a lengthy campaign and to sort of be a place of resort for voters who decide that they don't care for the other options. That's a hard story to feel victorious about. That's especially after a night when she lost this close to home, where we're talking about a lot of bedroom communities from Boston. She had a very bad day. She clearly is thinking that she might be able to endure a few more of those and still come out ahead. I don't know.
And Andy, I'll ask you about Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, frankly, if you had watched his campaign in New Hampshire, you would have seen last summer that he was not an electable candidate. He was not, in my view, he was never a front runner. He had led in national polls, but he really wasn't leading in the early states in Iowa and New Hampshire by much, especially by the time fall came around. He was being outraised by the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, when he was the vice president of the United States and a long-term senator. And he wasn't even getting the endorsements from people in the party that one would expect, given his history and past within the party. There were so many endorsements that were waiting in the wings to see how this was going to shake out. And if you watched any of his campaign events here in the summer, it really showed a small audience, lack of enthusiasm, and a very kind of disjointed, hard-to-follow message. And I'm trying to be polite there. So if you would have seen Biden in the summer, you would have said, this guy has no chance. He needs people within his circle to say, Joe, it's time to retire.
And before we go to a break, we've got to bring up that sort of the elephant in the room here, Mike Bloomberg. Ron, does what happened in Iowa and New Hampshire make Bloomberg a more viable candidate?
Mayor Bloomberg's had a good week. Biden's campaign imploding, Sanders coming into the lead, and the division of votes between Buttigieg and Klobuchar are all good things for him. But in the long term, he's going to face challenges he hasn't faced yet. He's been running a very, very commercial broadcast campaign in Super Tuesday states. He's spent a lot of money on that. He's not taking much fire. But, for example, Buttigieg has faced a lot of scrutiny of the relationship between the police and African-American communities in South Bend. Think of the scale of that story when we begin to turn to New York politics.
What do you think, Andy, about Bloomberg?
I agree with everything that just said. The other thing about Bloomberg in those Super Tuesday states and across the country where his poll numbers are starting to rise is he's campaigning in a vacuum there. None of the other campaigns have really set up shop there or spending money in those states. They're going through the typical state-by-state-by-state process that we've seen since 1972. One thing about Bloomberg, this is kind of shows the number of people that he has on his staff that are understand politics, is that he won Dixville Notch in New Hampshire. It's completely unimportant in terms of votes, or five votes up there, but they're able to count all of their votes at the polls at midnight if everybody in the town votes, and then count them up and put them in the newspaper. Well, he won both the Democratic side and the Republican side. And you know how he did that? He personally called all of the five voters in the state. All of the five voters in Dixville Notch. So it was a good lobby, and he was able to drive the media coverage. And if you had watched the TV on Tuesday morning, you would have seen that Dixville Notch numbers come up over and over and over, showing that he had won there.
So if somebody gets a gold star for being the most savvy last night, it's Mike
Absolutely.
Bloomberg.
The cheapest media push that anybody's probably had in American politics.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear your comments and questions about the presidential race at this point. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families. aarp.org/me. The law offices of Joe Bornstein, who believe that voting rights are the cornerstone of democracy. Learn more at vote.org/state/Maine. And MEMIC, who believes in a balanced workers' compensation system for Maine employees and employers. Learn more at MEMIC.com.
More than a million Americans have type 1 diabetes.
It became harder to recognize whether my blood sugar was going too high or whether it was going too low.
Some have turned to service dogs to help manage the disease.
But in fact, maybe the dog's right half the time.
The hope and the hype of diabetic alert dogs, plus New Hampshire primary analysis this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio.
Maysoon Zaid is a stand-up comic with cerebral palsy, and that's part of her shtick.
If there was an oppression Olympics, I would win the gold medal. I'm Palestinian, Muslim, I'm female, I'm disabled, and I live in New Jersey.
Laughing through the pain, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And that's coming up tonight at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what to make of yesterday's New Hampshire presidential primary? My guests are Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine, and Andy Smith, political science professor at the University of New Hampshire and director of UNH's Survey Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go up to Waldo and Kathy. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Good. Well, I've been listening very closely to all that's being said and has been said. But I think the fact that Bernie Sanders counts himself as a socialist is a good thing. And the fact that the Democratic candidates, other than Bernie, are saying, well, I don't know that somebody who calls himself a social democrat can really win in this country. Now, why would they say that? If the Democratic Party was really looking ahead, they would notice that mostly young people are interested in Bernie Sanders. And why is that? Because Bernie Sanders has the courage in a country that is, has been brought up on anti-communism for the last how many generations. And for people who just spit out, oh, socialized medicine, we don't want that. But the young people in this country are not being brainwashed to that degree anymore.
Kathy, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your call. And Andy, I'm going to guess that what you're going to say is that young people like Bernie, but they're not voting in very large numbers.
Well, that's part of it. But I think that she does have a point. For my students, if you talk about socialism, they're not thinking about the Soviet Union or communist China under Mao Zedong. They're thinking about the trip they took to Denmark or France last summer. So their perceptions of socialism are not conditioned by the Cold War environment that we grew up in. And that's one of, the problems in the Democratic Party right now is that there is this generational divide that was so clearly evident in 2016, where half of the Democratic electorate, you know, those people who are really under 40 or 45 years old, see the world in completely different ways than do the older people who largely control the levers of power within the party.
Ron, thoughts?
Well, first of all, thanks to Kathy for saying that. And I completely agree with Andy. The same is true very much of my students. But your point, though, also was the first thing to hit me is the question of even if young Democratic voters do see the world very differently from older people in the party, does that make them more likely to actually vote and to try to move the party in that direction? That, for me, remains an open question.
And didn't we see in New Hampshire yesterday, Andy, that fewer young people voted than were expected?
Yeah, it was down. But, you know, that's actually that shouldn't be a story, because any candidate that thinks they're really going to win a lot of elections on the backs of the young voters is probably going to lose a lot of elections, because they typically pay a lot less attention to politics and turn out at much lower rates than do their parents or their grandparents. It takes a lot to motivate young people to get out to the polls or even to pay attention to politics. They've got a lot of other things on their plate to worry about.
Kathy, thanks so much for your call. An email from Mary Ellen, and I'm going to put this one right back to you, Andy. Not sure how a rural, mostly white state is an indicator of the final national outcome.
Oh, it's absolutely not. It's a small state. We have no delegates. We have 24 delegates, and it takes a couple thousand to win. It's not indicative of that at all. It's just the momentum that you win on at the early stages that demonstrates that you can win elections, and that's ultimately what voters want in a nominee. But the one thing I would say about New Hampshire, and I don't want to, it's not really defensive of it, but it's very clear that for just about every election, New Hampshire has had the highest turnout. So that makes a very big difference in how you interpret the results. So Iowa, the record turnout in Iowa caucuses is 16%. New Hampshire routinely has turnout in the upper 40s or when there are two competitive primaries, over 50%. Some states don't have as high turnout in their presidential elections. So you've got an electorate here in the primaries that is much more reflective of a general election electorate. Part of the reason we see these last-minute swings, because the voters aren't locked into one candidate. So it is, I think, a better indicator of what's going to happen. And certainly political scientists who have looked at this indicate that New Hampshire is by far the most important state in the nominating process. Again, not because of the delegates, but simply because of the momentum that you get from winning New Hampshire or even coming second place in New Hampshire.
And Ron, tell me if I'm wrong here, but something else that strikes me as different about New Hampshire, and not just the demographics in terms of the color of people's skin, is that because of that it's a small state and because it's the first primary, voters have an opportunity to see and meet the candidates in a way that bigger states are not going to have. I'm guessing that somebody like a Mike Bloomberg is going to be more effective in a larger state where he's going to put on TV ads and voters don't have any expectation of meeting the candidates. Where in New Hampshire, they're making a personal decision. Maybe they've met three or four of the candidates. And that's kind of unusual, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I grew up in Southern California. I was amazed by the tenor of Maine politics when I got here, the degree to which people expect some kind of face-to-face relationship with elected officials. And we don't even have the kind of traditions that New Hampshire has. That's very important, I think, in terms of the skills that public officials need. Presidents, for as long as I can remember, have a tendency to downplay politics or to be sort of snide about politics. But that is absolutely central to any successful presidency, is political skill. And you can see that in a way with human interaction that you just can't in ads.
We'll go to Stefan calling from Bridgeton. Hi, Stefan. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I want to take issue a bit. I think it was with Andy's comment. You know, that Democrat voters always say they vote for any Democrat chosen. And not that they don't say that, but the implication is that it's true that they actually do that. Because if the same college-aged women and African-Americans who turned out for Obama had turned out for Hillary, we wouldn't be in this mess.
I think you were on to set it, didn't you? I mean, that they'll fall in line behind.
I know. I think that was Andy.
Okay, but Andy.
Yeah, it is true, but I think his point also is taken. It's not that they're going to go over and vote for Donald Trump, for example, in 2016 because they were Bernie supporters in 2016 in the primary. They just didn't vote. And I think that the perception within the Clinton campaign, this is one of the real tactical errors they made in 2016. They expected African-American turnout to be as high for Clinton in 2016 as it was for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012. And I think that was just an incredibly bad, boneheaded decision. So, yes, the issue is as described, but it's really a matter of will they turn out to vote. So Democrats, if they vote, they're going to vote for the Democratic candidate. The question is, can you get them to show up?
Did you want to add to that, Ron?
I think he's completely right. I often say to reporters that we have to concentrate more on turnout as a central question of what happens on Election Day. And the Democratic Party, depending on how the primary goes in particular, has to do what it can to maintain a sense among the voters that they are being heard.
Stefan, thanks for your point. We'll move on to Kenny Bunkport and Sadie. Hi, Sadie. Go ahead.
Hi. I actually am an organizer in New Hampshire for a campaign for global reproductive health care, the Fight for Her campaign. And I just wanted to say that it's amazing that all of the front runners here in New Hampshire do support repealing the Helms Amendment and Trump's global gag rule. And I think that speaks specifically to Granite Staters, that they care about reproductive freedom for all, not just in New Hampshire, but across the globe. And I think that's something that's really powerful, that the party is shifting into tackling the issue of abortion head on.
Interesting. Sadie, thanks so much for your call. And your point is that every candidate agrees. This is not one in which there's sunlight between the candidates on, Ron.
That's right. And thank you very much for calling with that point, Sadie. I mean, there are important distinctions between Senator Sanders and Mayor Buttigieg, for example, but there are also incredibly important similarities between them. And in terms of policy, the Democratic field is a lot more cohesive than it feels like it is to people who are only half paying attention, and very different from what the Republican Party has on offer.
All right. Sadie, thanks for your call. We'll move to Wiscasset and David. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question for Andy, whether he thought the new law making it harder for college students affected the turnout in New Hampshire at all.
I don't think there's really any evidence of it. What he's talking about is that New Hampshire passed a law that actually it doesn't require that you be a citizen of New Hampshire, but you have to swear when you're voting that you plan that New Hampshire is the state that you are residing in, and it's your home for voting purposes. I don't think that's made much difference. It certainly didn't make any difference in 2018. It's really easy to get around that law. So I tell my students, you can be from Massachusetts, have a Massachusetts license plate, have Massachusetts plates on your car, and pay out-of-state tuition, and you're more than welcome to legally vote in New Hampshire. And that's been made very clear to people. Certainly it has at college towns like Durham. There's been a tremendous amount of information that's been distributed across campus, both by the town itself as well as the Democratic Party here. And I don't think that was the key for the decline in turnout. It's really easy to vote, and it's really easy to vote in New Hampshire. It's still easier to vote in New Hampshire, I think, than any state in the country. The problem with getting the people to vote is in their heads. It's not any barriers, really, that are put in front of them.
David, thanks for your question. We have an email here from Mary. We'd never decide on a candidate based on a single debate performance. We're strongly behind Elizabeth Warren as a stellar candidate and phenomenal woman because we've studied her words and track record over the long haul. Sad to see the New Hampshire results, but onward we go. So, Ron, my question for you from Mary's email. Mary has studied the candidates and their track record. How usual is that, or how unusual is that for both a primary voter and a general election voter?
For a general election voter, it's very unusual. Most people who vote in the general election have made up their mind without doing any excess homework. Party in a lot of ways effectively stands in a general election for the kind of things you might learn from doing that level of homework. Primary voters are different, and I'm happy to hear that in Mary's household they pay that level of attention, but I'm not super surprised by it. I am struck by the degree to which the Warren campaign has effectively gotten this message out that although we're not happy with what happened yesterday, we're prepared for a long campaign. I think that's a theme we're hearing.
All right. And, you know, Andy, I don't think I asked you when we were talking about Elizabeth Warren, why don't you think she did better in New Hampshire?
I think the short answer is she peaked too early. She peaked in the fall, had a kind of bad debate performance in which she had to kind of backtrack her position on health care and change things around a bit. And one of my rules of thumb is that if you're in politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. But peaking too early isn't good. Her fundraising dried up in the fourth quarter. And frankly, people started to come around here and say, why should we buy Bernie Light when we can get a high-test Bernie with the original Bernie Sanders, because they were both largely competing for the same voters.
All right. Interesting. A Facebook post from Ed. I voted early for Bernie. My wife also. We really like Amy Klobuchar and want to have a woman on the ticket. We like Bernie's talking points, but we contribute money to Amy. We like Pete's ability to talk, but he doesn't have enough experience to get things through Congress, unless he would be great at the bully pulpit. We wish President Obama would have used it more. And again, another thoughtful voter taking his primary vote very seriously. But this idea of having a woman on the ticket, maybe a little early to have this part of the discussion, Ron, but do you think that it's going to benefit whoever is the nominee to have a woman on the ticket?
It is a little bit early. I would like to see that as well. I wouldn't expect any of the candidates or recent candidates to talk too much about that right now. A couple of weeks ago, there was a rumor that the Biden campaign had reached out to the Klobuchar campaign in Iowa and said, why don't we sort of work as partners and try to send each other, our voters, each other's way to make them stay above the 15% they need to qualify in the different Iowa caucuses. And the Klobuchar campaign was very uninterested in having that conversation. I think that the idea that they're jockeying in any way for a spot other than the top on the ticket is not correct.
All right.
Yeah, that was a very smart decision by the Klobuchar campaign not to make that deal.
Okay. If you'd like to join our conversation, and we'd love to hear from you about the presidential race, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And if you're real fast, you could get an email in to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from MEMIC, who believes in a balanced workers' compensation system for Maine employees and employers. Learn more at MEMIC.com. The Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at joebornstein.com. And AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families. AARP.org/ME.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On February 12, 1834, the American mythical character Paul Bunyan is listed as being born in Bangor. It is said that the giant lumberman was born in the deep Maine woods near the Queen City. Today, a 31-foot-high and 3,700-pound statue of Bunyan greets visitors into Bangor on Main Street. It was gifted to Bangor on February 12, 1959, Bangor's and Paul's 125th birthday, by New York-based builders Messmore and Damon.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, Dr. Robert Bullard is often called the father of environmental justice due to his work highlighting pollution in minority communities. Join us for a fascinating conversation with Dr. Bullard about climate change and its impacts on the world on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what is next in the race for the White House? My guests are Andy Smith, political science professor at the University of New Hampshire and director of the UNH Survey Center, and Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Before we move on, I want to talk about the three people who withdrew from the race in the last 24 hours. Yesterday, Andrew Yang and Michael Bennett, and this morning, Deval Patrick. Any surprises to you, Ron, with that list?
Not so much with the list itself, although I wasn't expecting Yang to get out exactly yet. The question for me now becomes what role they want to play going forward. I think that Yang in particular has some solid support and some infrastructure. He could be of value to the party, and I hope he does that.
All right. We will go, let's see, next to Mackenzie calling from Bethel. Hi, Mackenzie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually UNH alumni. So I just wanted to add to the comment about the lack of interest in young voters. I really disagree with that. I'm a millennial, and I feel like the topic of politics is a huge conversation between my friends and I, coworkers. It's kind of unavoidable almost. And I have friends from Baltimore, where I'm from, who have come up to New Hampshire and did canvassing for the weekend prior to the election. I see a lot of activity, but also something to consider about turnout is the infrastructure in our country and the socioeconomic status may really affect people being able to take off work and get to the polls. And also, if you're talking about places like Durham, New Hampshire versus Coos County, that voting experience is going to be a lot different. You know, whether it's how you get to the polls or how you vote, you know, or the accessibility, rural versus urban, is really going to impact voter turnout with young people.
Ron, thoughts?
I totally agree. The fact that Mackenzie has friends who come from Baltimore and New Hampshire, I think, is really heartening. But as a nation in which voting plays such a central role in our ideas of democratic legitimacy, we have so much work to do in making voting more accessible and a more obvious alternative to people from as soon as they can vote.
I'd push back just a little bit from the New Hampshire perspective, though. And it's great to hear from a Wildcat up there in Maine, especially since the hockey team's not doing so good this year. But in New Hampshire routinely has some of the highest turnout of any state in the country. So does Maine. And these are largely rural states. And we have really high turnout in our rural towns as much as we do in our cities. Both certainly in the general elections, but also in the primary. Again, we have really, really high turnout in the primary, far higher than any other state. So I don't think that there are so much barriers to turnout in sense of being able to get to the polls and so forth. But it's the mental concern about elections that keeps people from turning out. And this isn't new for this generation. Every generation votes at lower rates than do their parents. And as they get older and as they get more engaged and more socialized into the world, they pay more attention to politics and vote at higher rates as they get older.
And I understand Mackenzie's frustration because I also, all the young people I know are very engaged and do vote. But it's just the facts, right, Andy? I mean, it's just the numbers. As we know, who votes, and young people under age of 30 do not vote in as high as percentages as older people.
Yeah, unfortunately, the youth vote to me is always like Lucy holding the football for Charlie Brown. This time it's going to happen, but then she pulls the football out and Charlie Brown's laying on his back. So again, if a candidate says they're going to win with the youth vote, they're probably going to lose.
All right, we're going to go to Les, who's calling from Alna. Hi, Les, go ahead.
Hi, good to talk to you again. I've been a Republican for 50 years. I am no longer. I don't support liars. When I was in the legislature, I was regularly the most fiscally conservative. Someone should look at health care in terms of costs. We spend twice as much for health care in this country as any other developed country in the world, and we live 5 years shorter. Fiscal conservatives should pay attention to where the money's going. And Bloomberg, incidentally, is hiring up all the most sophisticated political operatives around the country and paying them big bucks right to Election Day. It's a fascinating thing to watch.
Thank you so much, Les, for bringing that perspective in and also for your service in state government. I agree with you in terms of healthcare, and I'm interested in seeing where the Bloomberg campaign is going to go.
Lee, thanks for your call. An email from Rick. I think there should be three nationwide primary elections spaced 2 to 3 weeks apart. States would be divided into three almost equal groups by population, smallest to largest. That would give small states some pull, but the last primary would be where the majority of delegates would be. So what do you think of that idea, Andy?
There have been a number of ideas that people have come up with over the years, and all of them have their advantages and all have their disadvantages. And I think the reason we haven't seen any significant change is first off, structural, because our electoral system is the powers given to the states to make rules. And there's nothing constitutional or even in real legislation about parties and what parties can do with their elections and their nomination processes. So it's very dispersed. The second problem is that elections within parties are largely run by fear, and that's fear of losing, and also importantly, the fear of the unknown. The one thing about the current system is that people understand how it works. Candidates understand how it works. Now, Michael Bloomberg this year is trying something different that really hasn't been tried since the 1970s. Maybe you could say Rudy Giuliani tried to do this in 2008. But the current system really will fall apart when people are really sure that the system that gets put in place is going to be understandable by the candidates. To the specific point about the three national primaries, the problem that I have with that is that it would the only kind of candidate that would have any chance to win in that sort of a situation would be the best known and the most highly funded candidates. Anybody like an Amy Klobuchar would have zero chance of getting the nomination or even really being on the same stage with these folks.
Interesting. Okay, we'll go to Scott, who's calling from Lisbon Falls. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, first off, I'm over 70. Second off, I campaign in New Hampshire, although I live in Maine. Last year, 4 years ago for Bernie. This year, I campaigned in New Hampshire, even yesterday for Elizabeth Warren. I was struck by the number of people yesterday who had still not made up their minds. They were still open to communicating about who to vote for. I was disappointed. I think Elizabeth lost a great deal of her votes with Amy Klobuchar. And I was disappointed. But I moved forward, and I am active now in politics for the first time in my life. So thank you very much.
Scott, did you like your experience in New Hampshire?
I loved it. I just enjoyed talking to the people. Even if they were, voting for somebody else, I enjoyed it so much. I was impressed. I wish I had started this way before my extremely late interest in politics.
Well, thanks so much for calling in. I was talking to my brother-in-law who lives in Keene, New Hampshire, and he told me he has never had so many people come to his door as during this campaign. Has lived there a long time, could not believe. And the one that was most interesting to him is that he has an 18-year-old son. There were Bernie surrogates looking for that son, knocking on the door and asking for him by name. So that's organized, isn't it?
That's very organized. And that's also, the fact that we had so many late deciders, I find really striking. And I know New Hampshire is different from a lot of places in that regard, but even so, we've had a broad, diverse field for a long time in this Democratic primary, and I hear people sometimes in the press who are clearly impatient with the messiness and the pace of it. But I think Democrats are really actually having a discussion about what they want the direction, not just of the nation, but of their party to be. And I think in the long run, that's a good thing.
I agree. Let me say one thing about the New Hampshire electorate. Again, it goes back to the idea that we have really high turnout and it's not activists that are out determining who wins. And frankly, for most people who aren't political activists, who really can't tell you the difference between anybody's health care policy or their immigration policy or anything else, they're looking at they're making up their mind really late because there's no reason for them to make up their mind early. They're probably not going to work for a candidate. They're probably not going to go out and see a candidate. For example, yes, you can see every candidate in the state, but only about 10 to 13% of people do go out and see multiple candidates. Most people don't. But that means also at the end of a campaign is when people start to pay attention. And for many people, it is those last minute events that make a big difference in who they vote for. All of the Democratic policies that you're hearing from the candidates, with maybe the exception of Andrew Yang, are very, very similar to each other. So it's like choosing a flavor of ice cream for many voters.
Scott, thanks so much for calling in. We'll go up to Falmouth and Doug. Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question. Earlier, one of your guests mentioned the high Republican turnout. I think it was some 128,000. Just by way of comparison, I'd like to know what the total, say, non-Trump vote was, which would be the total Democratic tally plus those who voted for Bill Weld. And speaking of Bill Weld, maybe just a couple of comments on what you think of his candidacy and if he has any opportunity to kind of put a dent in the Trump machine. Thanks.
I can answer the second question first. Bill Weld had no campaign here in New Hampshire. He was here, but he essentially had no campaign. It was him and a couple of guys walking around. Spent next to no money, and wasn't really it was more of a symbolic campaign than it was an actual campaign. Certainly, Republican turnout was much lower than Democratic turnout. That goes without saying because the Republican primary was just not a competitive primary. But the fact that Donald Trump was able to get more than twice as many voters show up than Obama was in 2012, and Trump is a far more divisive candidate on the Republican side than Obama was on the Democratic side in 2012, it, to me, is really stark. It's staggering. Trump had an event here in Manchester on Monday night where he had about 12,000 people in the arena and thousands of more people outside. And many of these guys had been waiting through 2 days of snow and rain and below freezing temperatures just to see Trump. There is a level of enthusiasm that I think has been generated largely by the impeachment or the constant attacks by Trump by the Democrats that galvanized Republicans behind him, even Republicans that don't really like his policies, that don't think that he's fiscally conservative or so forth. But he's the guy who's the head of their team.
I did some quick math and I added up the votes. It looks like about 210,000, Andy, in the Democratic primary. Is that about right?
About right. But
okay.
The fact that there were about 140,000 people in a non-competitive Republican primary is really amazing. We've not seen anything like that in New Hampshire primary history, which further points that Democratic turnout wasn't anywhere near as strong as many people thought it would be.
All right. Well, Doug, thanks for your call. We're going to go to David in Auburn. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm an independent voter, and I get angry at this point in the cycle because I'm shut out. I'm not allowed to participate. And I just wanted to ask the panel if they ever see a time when the independent voter will be welcomed into the primary process, and are there enough of us to make a difference?
Sure, David. I have no idea what the noise is in your phone, but so, Ron, this is state by state, correct? And
that's right.
Here in Maine, you have to register for a party. You can do so at the last minute, but you have to register for a party to vote in the primary. But Andy, in New Hampshire, anybody can vote, right?
Well, not really. If you were registered as a Republican or a Democrat, you could not vote in the opposing party's primary unless you had changed your status to the other party or to what we call undeclared back in October. But about 40% of our registered voters are registered undeclared. Some people, unfortunately, call them independents, which makes it seem like they're free agents politically. They turn out at lower levels than do registered Democrats and registered Republicans, in part because they're younger and just pay less attention to politics. So they can vote in the primaries. The way it works is you walk up to your polling place, you register. They'll ask you which ballot you'd like to take. And while you have that ballot in your hand, you're a member of that party, Democrat or Republican Party. Mark your ballot, you turn it in, and then you can change your status back to undeclared before you leave the polling place. It's easy to be undeclared. It's kind of nice because you don't get hit up by the parties for fundraising and all of those things. You're not publicly identified as a member of a party. But it's important to not think of that as a separate block. The undeclareds or the independents in New Hampshire are really three blocks. One block are really Democrats, about 35%. They look like Democrats. They act like Democrats. They believe in Democratic policy positions. About 30% are really Republicans, and they're very similar to Republicans. And about 35% are truly independent, and they don't vote in primaries. They just don't bother to show up. The reason they're independent is they just don't pay much attention to politics.
Well, David, thank you so much for your call. That's going to be our last call. Ron, I wanted to ask you about Nevada, but we're almost out of time. If you have a five-second comment, I'll you shoehorn it in.
The Sanders campaign has 11 offices and about 250 paid volunteers. The Buttigieg has 12 offices and 100. We're seeing an infrastructure on the ground in Nevada, and I'm interested to see what that's going to translate to.
All right. That's Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at USM. Also with us, Andy Smith from the University of New Hampshire. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.